Good evening, it's Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My special guest tonight, good friend Brian Barlow. He was the general manager of WICN, I think, through the most critical stage of the station. You were here and ushered us through that. And you were also on air personality, too. And I decided we needed to get all your history down. We really did.
Well, my memory fades.
Seriously. The first thing I wanted, and I don't think I ever knew this, when did you first become aware of WICN? Not participate, but when did you become aware?
About the same time, someone walked into my store in Worcester that I owned and said...
Right. I forgot about that whole...
Yeah. And she said to me, she was on the air, I said, you have a good radio voice. You should be on the radio. I said, well, thank you. And she said where she worked, which was ICN. So I just called up our former... person, Gene Pettit, who worked here forever, and I said, hey, I'm your next radio guy. And he said, well, wait a minute. Got to come down and meet you. But it worked out.
I thought you were going to slip into an imitation of Gene at that
moment. No, I thought about it, but couldn't do it.
Okay.
So anyway, I started going in the air. I thought, what a thrill. I was frightened to death.
What did you do?
I was doing the Tuesday morning Tasteful Blend show for a couple of years that way. And I... was first frightened, and then I became very comfortable and fell in love with it, you know, doing the music. At the station, you kind of free rein to what you play within an umbrella of jazz, for example.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great. I love music so much, and here I was.
At this point, it's really important for the audience to know that we were not a jazz station.
At that time, we were called Central Mass Stations for Jazz, NPR News, and more. No brand at all.
And for people who don't remember or don't know the history of WICN, we started out as an intercollegiate station. We were at WPI and Holy Cross, which is when I came on board.
Yeah.
Then we were on Grove Street. Is this one? Were you
no.
on? No. Okay. Grove Street was weird.
I've heard it was Pitt.
It was. Yeah. It was. The library, the rock library, you had about that much space to walk between the wall and the records. Then we got to Chatham Street, which is where you were.
Yes.
Now let's talk about Chatham Street.
Yeah, that was a trip as well.
It was a completely different trip.
Well, it was.
What was the most dramatic architectural feature of Chatham Street?
Well, for us, being in the cellar, it was the pool with the showers and the saunas that were there in the changing rooms. That was their entire industry was right inside there. Because we had no money. We got the bottom.
And the record library was in the pool.
It was in the pool, yes.
I can remember it tilted down towards the back end. So you actually went to the deep end.
And then they put boards above it so we could have a little more office space up there. But the farther deep end was flooded, so we couldn't go further than that wall. But we had desks all around.
That's right.
The pool side. And there we were operating.
Well, there was also a manager's office or something like that, wasn't there?
Yeah, I don't know what that was originally. It's probably the girl's shower or something. But we had a little hole in the wall.
We had a production, a so-called production studio.
Yeah.
And then we had sort of an extra room. It was a weird space.
It was a weird space. We didn't have very good air conditioning or heat. We had black mold.
We had a flood.
We had many floods.
Yeah, I can remember a really dramatic one where there had to be boards down because the water was rising.
Yes, and we did the show on boards on the radio station way back when. The charming times, but, you know, it was a charming place in many ways, but rough.
Wow. Yeah. I don't know what drugs you're doing, but I want those drugs. Charming would be like the last word I would use for...
Well, we did clean up a little bit.
We did.
But the tough thing became too many floods, and the building became basically condemned, and we had to move out within a year.
Some of the personnel that were there, you ended up bringing all the way over to here, to Salem Street, and that included Melissa. I think Melissa started at Chatham Street.
Well, yeah, actually the staff that was there prior to my arrival and arrival, they moved on pretty quickly, one reason or another.
He's being very politic, by the way, because and I'm not going to talk about them either.
No.
But there's some very interesting stories. But suffice it to say,
yeah.
How did you manage to get to be general manager at that very chaotic time? And it was a chaotic time. I wasn't sure the station was going to survive.
Well, that was the question the board had. But for me, I had sold my business in about 1997, and I chose to take a year or two off. Meanwhile, still being on the air as a DJ. Now it was the Fridays at that point. And I heard that they had an opening. Now, I was privileged to hearing all the people's complaints and problems. I was a trusted person, and so I knew too much.
I remember this period well.
Yeah.
Standing up.
Yeah,
go ahead.
And so anyway, I applied for the job, and I knew a lot, and I ran a business successfully, and I thought they had a lot of potential, and that's where I came in.
Okay, and from a person on the other end, all I can say it was like, a 180 of suddenly sort of, hey, kids, let's put on a show.
Yeah.
To like, wow, we're a business?
Yeah, well, it was. I had no idea the debt we were in, and the transmitter never worked at all. It was off once a week. The staff was really not in good moods any longer. And of course, the building itself was tough. So we had challenges. I mean, there was $130,000 in debt I inherited, plus deferred salary, and we had no money. Anyway, so that's what I walked into. So I took a very low salary.
You got to explain to me why you thought that was an attractive proposition.
Because, like, I have always been helping businesses that were launched or in trouble.
Were you also just intrigued because it was radio and you had a thing for radio?
Yeah, I loved radio and as well. But I had done five businesses beforehand who were going out of business, and I made them work. So for me, I saw potential here. They just weren't doing anything they should have done. So I wanted the challenge. It was hell for the first 2 years, believe me. I'm glad you were my friend at the time chatting a bit. But
All I can say, right, there were a lot of dismissals.
Yeah.
But they were needed dismissals.
It was a cleaning of the house, essentially.
It was.
Yeah.
I've seen that happen in art museums, too,
yeah.
to good effect. And there's a lot of Sturm und Drang while it's going on. But if it's a person who's behind the desk who has a vision, it makes all the difference in the world.
Well, it does. We were blessed to have a few people as volunteers that were befitting perfect staff.
Yeah.
And we slowly hired. Now, bear in mind, I liked the people that were there before, but I understood their situation.
There were a few
that
I'm not so fond of.
Well, perhaps.
And we know who they are.
I don't know anything about that. But, you know, anyways, we slowly started building a staff, and they were hungry to work, and they had a dream, and we changed things, and I predicted some pretty bold things, like doubling our underwriting in 1 year, and
then
new
you
facility.
Predicted we were going to move
to
another better facility in a couple of years, and I thought you were insane. And so that was the point in which I went, wait a minute, what is he smoking?
We had a lot to do because we had to replace the transmitter, so I did that. But it was a nice thing. Our engineer at the time and myself put up $2,000 to challenge the board to join us and buy a new one, and they did. We raised $25,000. We bought the new transmitter.
Wow.
And then meanwhile, was raising more money going out there because that's what I can do, and we were finding a lot more corporate support, and that was helping.
That alone...
Yeah,
is producing a change in the tone of the station right there. Because
suddenly we're
doing, like, we were definitely hand to mouth.
Yes, but we had people with a lot of faith and hope in what was going to go in the future.
Yeah.
Before there was none. So even though I wasn't sure myself, I put myself in line to say, we're going to have a new place with a recording studio and a new production studio, a beautiful library and all that. We're going to have this in three or four years.
I remember you.
Yeah.
I clearly remember you saying that. And I clearly remember I couldn't believe it was going to happen.
Yeah, I'd go talk to my wife at home and say, how am I going to do this? Because the first 2 years were a battle, as you know.
I'll have you know, the rest of the staff was like, right.
Yeah,
right,
yeah, yeah.
Right, wink, wink. Yeah, sure. Okay, we'll be doing that. When it happened, I was like, holy crow.
Well, we had an advantage of one sort. It was actually the worst thing that happened to us. We had another flood. Then we had the condemnation. And the building... owners told us we had literally, I think it was 11 months to get out. So that put a sense of urgency on the foundations.
Yeah.
Luckily, which I knew to do was to befriend a lot of the people in the foundations and talk to them, met with them, told about my vision. So when I came
that's a very specific skill.
Anybody who's in a GM should meet everybody and build a friendship for everyone. Be kind to them, be good to them. Yeah.
There's a way to schmooze,
and
you need that skill if you're in your position.
Oh, absolutely. And plus, I really like doing it. I like these people. You know, we're all working in the same community, and it's nice to have it. So when
I already feel like writing a check to the station just listening to you.
Well, they were good to us. And so while I'm running the station trying to do underwriting and get the membership up, I'm also heading the capital campaign and trying to raise $1 million at the same time within 11 months. And we raised almost that amount of money, which was impressive. And so with the help of Mike Gorman, a fabulous architect,
he
was president at the time, and he decided he would give us the drawings and the design once they found a building, which was a trip, because we had to drive around all the time outside of my work and look at all these spaces in the new arts district. It never happened. We looked at other places, but we had to have a place with a line of sight to Boylston's Tower, and that's hard to find.
That's how radio works, by the way, if you don't know that
at
in
that
the listening audience.
And we found one.
You've sort of found a perfect thing now. The story I remember you telling me, and I just want you to let me know if it's true,
yeah,
is he walked in and WICN was on. They had it piped through the building.
Well, yeah, I walked in cold called Wyatt, who's upstairs running the building. And when I walked in, he was playing ICN on his computer. And I introduced myself. He said, oh, my God, he welcomed me with big arms. And I said, do you have any space? And he thought he might be able to manage it. And actually, they just moved out of here, up there. And so I asked how much, and it was looking about 5,000 square feet. We got about 4,000 something down here. So this is perfect. But then he wanted outrageous rent. And I said to him, he was talking $25, and I'm saying $7 a foot. And we agreed to terms and signed a 20-year lease. And then their architecture design began, and I would oversee it, and we let all the staff look at it and think for flaws. We did that for 6 months. You might have participated.
I remembered that.
Yeah, and eventually we thought we had it all together, and they started building the thing while we ran the station and funded it as we went along. We had problems with asbestos, and we had all kinds of things. We had to move all the heating vacs and get rid of the sound that they made. It was a lot to do, more than we thought. But we made it in budget.
Talk to me about moving day. Yeah. That was a classic thing if you weren't there for it for WICN.
Well, I don't remember a lot about it. Hate to say.
Didn't it happen like one weekend?
Oh, yeah. We got everything over in a weekend. We had planned to actually have a bucket brigade.
I remember that.
Remember? People were going to bail out the pool with the records and pass them down a line of people to the printers building, which is about 1,000 feet away.
Right, yeah, we could have done that. People were talking about sort of putting a slide.
Yeah, something like that. But wait a minute, we just took all the stuff out. Everyone helping hands. Boxes, boxes, boxes. The furniture. We didn't have a lot besides albums. And they're heavy. And CDs. But we got it all in there. And I think it was Monday morning, Joe Zupan got on the air. We're there at 6 a.m. drinking champagne. And Joe plays This Is New by Dee Dee Bridgewater.
Wow.
And rocked off the new station. We were on because behind the scenes, everyone's wiring the station
up,
the satellite dishes. They got it all done. I mean, and there it was. I couldn't believe it. We pulled it off in 3 years.
When you walked into the station for the first time at that point, that was another major sort of thing to let you know that things had changed at the station.
Oh, yeah.
It looked like a place of business. And now it looked like a place of radio and radio business, but it definitely looked serious and adult.
And it was. It was well designed by Mike Corbin and company. And we wanted to make sure that the community knew this was a place open to them for music and to come and visit. And, of course, all the artists. My dream was also if every single artist traveling through New England would make this a stop, a must stop.
Yeah.
And that started to happen as well.
Well, we'll get into that in a little bit.
Because
some amazing people came down the station at that point.
Yeah.
But one of the other things you had to do is to change the format.
Yeah.
And talk to me about your thought processes about that. And when did that start?
That started prior to the move. It was a case of we weren't doing well at all with so many formats.
Well, we were a classic community radio station.
We were trying to.
We had everything.
Yeah.
And I love those shows. We had the Irish Hour, and we had the Lithuanian Hour, and we had this and that. And it was all sort of a hodgepodge. We had classical music on in the afternoon for a while, and the jazz in the morning. And then you made a very bold decision to make this a jazz station.
Well, knowing branding, because I did that for the other businesses as well. I mean, if you thought about local AM radio news, you'd think of TAG. If you think about BUR for news, you'd think of them for NPR news and so forth. And we had nothing to do with that. What we were doing well with, more so than anything else, was jazz, essentially. We did have some successful folk programs, too. So I thought we would just simply call it, a jazz station. But then the problem became, should it be Worcester's jazz station, Massachusetts jazz station, Central Massachusetts, et cetera? And I realized, we touched three states, so why not go big and call it New England's jazz station? About a year later, enough folk people said, can you add folk to it at the end? So we did that as well. So we became New England's jazz station with some folk music. I couldn't use the word Americana because that's not a good brand.
It isn't.
But that's what we were.
That sounds archaic.
Yeah. So we had that brand and we advertised it like crazy in print at the time.
Now, there's no competition really, is there? I mean,
not for this.
Not for a jazz station.
Well, we had GBH at night and a few
places. But see, they were doing what we had been doing before. Yeah. So they were GBH who did a lot of other things, especially the news.
Yeah.
And they had jazz in the evening. But we were becoming a jazz station.
Well, we were doing what they were doing. They had 50,000 watts. We had about 7. You know, so we really couldn't compete. They had better branding. So we had to find our niche. And that seemed likely it.
Yeah.
And we went with it. But also I changed some of the programming because it was interesting when you... Something was wrong with jazz radio. So I would look at the charts, there's many charts, and on Billboard, you would see the most successful artists in terms of how well they do in concert, you can get the numbers, how many records they sell, et cetera. And you saw this top 10 or top 100. Then I look at jazz radio play, and it's like the total reverse of the artists. So
we were like, and I happen to like my favorite form of jazz is like bebop and
outro. Sure.
So we were playing that.
Yeah.
And we were ignoring the artists, popular artists.
Yeah, exactly. And no one else is playing them anyway.
Right.
So I thought, you know, we've got to think about this and start focusing a lot on these artists. And also.
There was rebellion.
Sure, there was. There were always everything
there,
I did.
There were some great fights. And I won't mention people.
I won't either.
But there was always fights about the playlist.
Yes. Well, whatever. You know, I had.
You actually had a playlist.
We did for what? We had suggested artists that
we thought would be mixed
in mostly throughout the day. But when you. And the other rule we had here was you wouldn't play the same song in 30 days. Yet, popular radio, for better or worse, top 40, would rotate the number one song probably every 40 minutes on the air because they want to catch the audience who's on for about 20. So they give them what they want. Now, learning those lessons, we had to be a kind of a mixture of all of that. And I forced that on everybody. But son of a gun, we went from, I think it was 19,000 listeners. In the second year, we were at 40,000 listeners, just like that, doubling. Because we did have ads as well. And the ads were very cool in print. They had like this white and black towers. And it would say like Tasteful Blend. And you'd see the big names like B.B. King, Diana Krall, Dave Brubeck, the names people love, Sinatra. And that's where we featured. And you would hear them now, but you'd also get other stuff as well. And it worked.
You were also great about new artists.
Well, yeah, we wanted to dedicate.
There's a whole tone. That was another whole tone that changed in the station, is that you would try to push, and the station through you, you through the station, would push new and emerging artists, and we became known for that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, jazz artists mostly aren't that famous anyway, but our thought was to let's show what kind of talent is out there. And the new artists, I think, are the future. Why not be the first? So, yeah, we found a good CDs. Let's play it, and let's play it, and let's play it, and get them in here and help their career a bit. Even put them on stage, you know, a few times. And we became known for that as well. You know, to be a local jazz station that gets these local artists who have no chance, airplay and sometimes concert stage. And that was, I was very proud to do that. Almost every day we had new artists coming in here, new artists, and it was great to have them.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. I'm having a great conversation with Brian Barlow, former general manager of WISN, who really ushered the station in through a major change that redefined the station. And we've been talking about that. You brought a lot of interesting new people on.
You mean on the
air?
Yes.
One story, and I need to, because he's told me this story, and I need to hear it from you.
Well, I don't know which one you're referring to.
Tom Shaker.
I thought you might go that way.
Okay. Tom Shaker swears that he came in, and he wanted to do a jazz show?
Yeah, an old-timey jazz show he wanted to do.
Now, how did you know that he should have been doing a soul show?
Well,
that's like my now favorite show in the entire station.
No, he's great. Well, I asked him, I mean, that's cool, but what else do you like? And he said, I like soul music. And I thought about it, and, you know, that's certainly Americana and, you know, jazz, I don't know. But I thought, Monday night, that'd be perfect. So I thought, let's take a shot. It's popular music. No one's playing it either. And Tom liked it because you have to like the music to be on the air here.
He's had a whole history of like going, visiting the artists, going to all the concerts. He goes to the places where they were born.
Well, the jazz artists, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, no, the soul artists.
Oh, yes, too, yes.
So he's got that whole history. Yeah. And it's like he found what he wanted to do.
Well, I was pleased. He's a great guy, of course, in every way personally. And he was a great DJ. And I had no worry about him at all. He just did it. And he did it better than I could have ever done it.
Right.
And so, you know, this is luck. Like Joe Zupan was luck, you know.
Joe Zupan was great, and the on-air studio is named after him. Unfortunately, he's passed away.
Yeah,
but that was a major talent too. I mean, you brought in people who were going to be good on-the-air personalities up until that point before you. Yeah. Basically, we were filling airspace.
Okay. With stuff.
And I know this from the rock department. Yeah. Because we were on from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m.
Yeah.
And to get somebody to go from the 3 to 6, basically you're looking for a warm body that knows how to spin records, and that's it. But you were actually starting to like talk and think about their on-the-air presence and what they were projecting.
Well, programming begets audience. That comes right down to that.
That's right.
And we need audience, of course, and the more the better. You know, Joe was a funny one. He was on the station for years, beloved by the community, but he called me from, I think it was in Washington State at the time, said, I'd like to be your DJ. And I said, well, it'd be great, but I can't hire you on the phone if you can get here. And he did. And I talked to him. He was very charming. I loved his voice. I loved his passion, his humility. I thought, you know, Worcester's a tough town to get to know. Are you okay living by yourself here and doing this show? You're not going to get very rich. He said, yeah. And sure enough, he moved into this town. He made tons of friends, played in many bands, and was one of our best DJs ever for the jazz shows. He had them both Tasteful Blend and on Jazz Matinee. And it was sad to lose him. He was a good friend that...
He was a good guy.
He was a good guy.
He was a good guy.
But we had talent. We brought in Carole Sloan in. You know, he was a number was best seven, the seventh best jazz singer in the world, according to Billboard.
That freaks me out that we had those kinds of people.
Yeah, we did. And that's the kind of quality we wanted on the show. Real people, real passion. We had a movement. We're going to have all female DJs for a while, which we almost did with Tira Penn and Monica Hatch and Carole and all that. And that lasted for a while. But people come and go. But they're all musicians, too, all these people.
And that's an important thing because they bring a whole different perspective on
air.
They
sure do, yeah.
And they also help bring people down to the station.
Yes, they do. But, you know, and I'll say this, too. You know, most radio stations don't have people who love the music. They're just DJs by trade. And here we have people with a passion for the music playing the music. So for me, I mean, that's the best way to go.
Well, first of all, this is predominantly a volunteer station.
Yes.
There is a couple of paid people on the air. Most of us are volunteers. And so for us to do this, you have to be passionate about it. But that's not it all. You need to be passionate and relatively competent and know how to do it.
You know, it's a funny thing because I found that most people could talk very well but knew nothing about jazz. And if I asked about jazz, what do you like? John Coltrane and Miles Davis, they would say, which said to me they know nothing about jazz. And then the other people were really jazz knowledgeable but couldn't talk on the air at all or make it happen, the engineering. It was tough to find that magic person. But we managed to get many in, you know, eventually over time.
Now, we're going to continue this over the next half hour, too. But one of the other things that started happening at the station is, as you alluded to and talked about, big names, people started visiting the station.
Yeah.
Emmylou Harris came down here.
Yeah, I don't remember that one. But yes, I think she did.
Yes, she did.
Yeah, no. Well,
didn't one of the Monkees come down here?
Yeah, he came down twice.
Peter Tork
came down here. Pete Best from the Beatles came down.
Pete Best from the original Beatles.
Yeah, plus we had the people like John Pizzarello. We had Toots Thielemann come in. We used to have a birthday visit from David Fathead Newman every year. And he brought in Curtis Fuller, who just passed away, who was a trombonist for John Coltrane and many, many others. He lived in Millbury, of all things. And they'd visit every year, at least, and just say hi. But almost every week, we had two or three people, noted people, on the air interviewing or playing here sometimes. Kenny Rankin came here and played for people for 2 days. Linda Ronstadt came in a wonderful concert.
Linda Ronstadt, right.
She spent 3 days here. And loved Worcester so much, she went shopping for real estate after her stint with us.
What?
I don't make that up.
Come on. I didn't know that story.
Well, she was living in Tucson, and it was really usurped by strip malls. The whole town was gone. But she saw original charm in the city and looked around to see if there's something. Plus, she had friends up here, too. She eventually did not buy here, but she did buy in San Francisco.
Your relentless positive outlook scares me.
Linda Ronstadt wants to move to Worcester.
But that's like typical Brian. Yeah. That's like the best possible situation we could do.
Yeah, yeah.
And that matters. If you're going to be the general manager of a radio station that has to face the public all the time, you need that. Well, are there times that you just went home and you pulled your hair out?
Well, of course it did. You know, I the energy I turned on every day to be positive and make treat every people nicely was sincere.
I know that.
But when I gave it up at night, I didn't want to talk to anybody because I'm a big introvert. You know,
I am too.
I know, and that's we can do it all out there, but you got to kind of get back together by being silent for a couple hours, which I did at night. So we did that, but yes.
So at what point did you realize the station is now, it's on a different track and it's making it?
Well, pretty soon we moved in and I started the activity over the first 6 months. All of a sudden we had a fair amount of cash on hand. We had built out state-of-the-art studios. We had a great staff at that point working, people like Melissa and Karen, and we had many engineers. I'm sorry, I'm not leaving people out here, but and we were rolling. We were doing very, very well. That's why I thought, let's advance our cause and let's really launch concerts.
You know? Okay, and that's going to be the topic for the next installment of this. If you're listening, and I hope you are, we're going to continue this conversation with a part two conversation with Brian Barlow, general manager of WICN, who took us through some of the most critical years of the station and literally transformed the station into what you're listening to now. And Brian, so stay tuned. You've been listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.